Good afternoon, I'm Jason DeRose. This is the second session in Unearned Intimacies on the Ethics of Telling Other People's Stories. I know that many of you were not here in the session on Tuesday, so I wanted to start by reviewing a little bit the idea of unearned intimacy. And the best way to review that is to start perhaps with the idea of earned intimacy. Does anybody remember what earned intimacy, well, at least what I gave examples of as an earned intimacy? Or maybe you have your own examples.
A college reunion you talked about.
Okay, so these are people you've known for a while.
Right.
And you know, you were there at some formative moments for each other, so longtime friends. Mm-hmm. Other examples of people with whom you have earned intimacy.
Marriages.
Okay. You've got up to 20, 30, 40 years. You know each other. You've seen each other at your best and worst. Maybe one more example of an earned intimacy.
A professional relationship like a pastor or a doctor.
Right. Somebody, a pastor or a doctor that you have had professional but intimate relationships, where intimate conversations with. So how about unearned intimacies? Does anybody remember how I talked about that on Tuesday? Was that unearned intimacy?
It's in your role as a journalist, you meet somebody and within a very short period of time, you're hoping to dig into fairly personal details about the story.
Right. So the idea of unearned intimacy is, I don't know that it's unique to the journalistic encounter, but it is definitely a way to describe the journalistic encounter. So you enter somebody's life in a particularly strange, difficult, maybe joyful moment, and you're asking them profound questions about their experience. Well, first of all, you're just asking them about the experience, which might be a difficult thing to discuss. And then you're asking them to reflect on that experience with you. And perhaps you're asking them to reflect before they're even ready or before they've even processed it, especially during, say, a tragedy, where, you know, as we heard, you know, the building collapses, you know, your relative within that building. Let's talk about that now. I should say for this session, two of the three pieces I'm going to play are adult content, not the right word. One of them is about sexual assault, and one of them is about abortion. So I want to just have everybody know that there will be some very sensitive issues being talked about. I think that in a session on unearned intimacies, talking about those issues is probably par for the course. So I apologize if that is problematic for people, but I also think that these pieces will broadcast on our mission and all things considered. So 30 million people have already heard them.
How are they doing?
Well, okay, I wanted to tell you this, actually. You know, most of what I do is talk to reporters. I stand in an office in Culver City, California, and I never actually interact with audiences. So one of the reasons I love coming to Holden and doing this is that I get to play pieces, many of which I've worked on, and two of the pieces today are pieces I edited, for audiences, and I actually get to see and hear your reactions to these pieces. I am sometimes working in a bit of a vacuum as to what is the need of the audience for this story, but I'm also, I try to be very conscious of the fact that I'm producing these for somebody. I'm not doing this for the sake of doing journalism. I do know a lot of investigative journalists feel like they're doing journalism for the sake of doing the journalism and holding the public people accountable. That is an important part of what the journalistic enterprise does. I'm not on our investigative unit. I am very interested in the work that I am doing being heard by an audience so that they can understand it, not just like so that the governor can hear that his, you know, Secretary of Transportation is corrupt or something like that. So I'm very interested in your feedback, and I want to hear it. Right? I want to hear feedback. So I want to start this afternoon with an idea that came up in a series that I was editing this past fall. So NPR, in collaboration with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, which I had to say every time on the radio because they were a partner. I couldn't just say the Harvard School of Public Health or Harvard. But we did a big national survey about discrimination in America, and we had various cohorts that we were looking at, African-Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, LGBT people, women, white people, men, Asian Americans. So I edited the Native American and the LGBT portions of that series. And there have been eight pieces in the Native American, maybe nine, and then five in the LGBT portion of that national survey on discrimination. The reason that there are so many pieces on Native American discrimination is that this was one of the very, there haven't been a lot of opinion polls of Native Americans, and we surveyed people from across the country, Native Americans, or people who identified as Native American from across the country, so we're still mining that data for stories. But I'm not gonna play this whole story for you, I'm just gonna play an excerpt from a story. This was a piece about employment discrimination against Native Americans. And a man named Howie Echohawk, who is a works in communications advertising right now in Seattle, told us the story of an experience he'd had earlier in his career. I think right when he was out of college, he was bartending, and he had a mohawk, which is part of his tradition. And the bar manager said, "You can't serve here with a mohawk." I think that that's odd because I feel like in a place like Seattle, like business people have mohawks. But here's how. So he told us the story, and then we asked him to reflect on telling us the story. What was it like to have to explain that story over and over to people? And he had this moment where he sort of he answered the question, but he actually looked at us and said this.
This is something that feels important for anybody who's trying to understand when somebody has to talk about their oppression to the people who benefit from that oppression. It is, you're pleading your humanity. And to do that, it's hard.
Let me play that one more time for you.
This is something that I feel is important for anybody who's trying to understand when somebody has to talk about their oppression to the people who benefit from that oppression. It is, you're pleading your humanity. And to do that, it's hard.
So him saying that to me really, I didn't say it to me, he said it to my reporter. I felt like we were called on the carpet for asking him to help us understand his oppression. We were asking him to do most of the work. I think that, a lot of the work. I mean, reporters and there were other people in the story as well. We were asking him to do a great deal of work for us because of our curiosity, but also because we wanted other people, listeners, the 30 million people listening to NPR, to understand what his experience was. But I keep coming back to this phrase that he uses, pleading our humanity. And these pieces aired in November, and I've taken that to heart whenever I'm editing other stories since then, and keep that idea of pleading our humanity in mind. Because I think that a lot of the stories that I edit, especially since I edit religion stories, Native American stories, LGBT stories, I often have people in these pieces trying to explain to people who are not like them why they're human beings. And I think that that is a very difficult position to put people in. I think it's a necessary position for journalists to put people in, but I think we should all think as a culture about asking people to explain themselves and asking people to help us understand you. So I want to start with the first piece. This is from that same Native American discrimination series. This piece aired on All Things Considered in the fall, mid-November of last year.
Native Americans say a major problem they face is institutional discrimination. That's a finding of a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In Indian country, they call it environmental racism. During World War II and the Cold War, mining companies blasted 30 million tons of uranium out of Navajo land. Since then, many residents have died of conditions linked to that contamination. Laurel Morales, member station KJZZ, reports from Blue Gap, Arizona.
Helen Mez had 10 children. Now she only has 3. 7 of her children died of a disorder called Navajo neuropathy, which is linked to uranium contamination. Many people died, and some have liver disease, kidney disease, and some suffer from cancer as a result. When she was pregnant, Nez and her children drank from a spring that today has uranium levels at least 5 times that of safe drinking water standards. 4 of her children died as toddlers, 3 died in early adulthood. It is worrisome and troublesome, and you hope that something will be done. In the new NPR poll, more than 1 in 4 Native Americans say the quality of their drinking water is worse than in other places to live. Nez's sister, Sadie Bill, drives out to an abandoned uranium mine near the spring called Claim 28. Along the way, she points to the site of her neighbor's home that had to be hauled away. It was so contaminated.
So she passed on about 2.5 years ago. And this one over here, she was on dialysis. And she passed on 8 to 9 months ago.
People on the outside world then said, well, what's wrong with you? Get out of there, move. That's not economically or culturally feasible.
Chris Shuey is an environmental health scientist who's been studying the impacts of uranium mining on the Navajo people for almost 4 decades. It turns out Navajos are tied by tradition to the land where they're born.
People have been captive to these exposures now for 3 generations.
The community and many others like it want to know why it's taking the federal government so long to clean up the abandoned mines. In the NPR poll, 39% of Native Americans say discrimination based on laws and government policies is a bigger problem than discrimination based on individuals' prejudice.
The slow pace of cleanup is directly related to the law itself. The law places more importance on the relationship between EPA and the companies that caused the problem than it creates a right of sitting at the table of the local affected community. And so on Navajo, that is institutional racism.
In this case, Shuey says the policies of the Energy Department, the EPA, and the tribe have hurt the Navajo people. Of the 500 abandoned mines, the EPA has only cleaned up 9 so far. And Shuey says cleanup presents a lot of challenges.
There's not a lot of places to take this stuff to. You invariably put it in somebody else's backyard.
The EPA wouldn't make anyone available for an interview, but it said in a statement the federal government has reached settlements valued at $1.7 billion with mining companies, enough to clean up about 40% of the abandoned mines.
The EPA is really caught between a rock and a hard place.
University of New Mexico toxicologist Matt Campen is studying the air quality surrounding abandoned mines.
They get attacked by both advocacy groups for not doing enough and by industry for doing too much.
Campen says it comes down to allocation of resources and authority to get things done. A Navajo group is currently evaluating the cost to remediate the mine near Helen Nez and her sister Sadie Bill's home.
We lost too many people. We don't want our future young people to have to go through this again.
At the current rate, it would take multiple generations for the Navajo to be free of uranium contamination. For this family and for many others, though, it's already too late. For NPR News, I'm Laura Morales in Blue Gap, Arizona.
So I want you to... So I want you to think with me for a few minutes about whose story this is. I think I asked this question about one of the pieces yesterday. Is this the story of the subject of the story, the Nez's? Is this Laurel Morales' story? Is she in charge of this story? Is this the story of the community, the Navajo Nation? Is this a story of the institutions, either the nation's government or of the federal government, of the EPA? Who do you think is the main character among those? Who's the main storyteller?
I mainly heard the male voice, who is like a scholar or a researcher, something summarizing the issues of
right. Right, so you, in this piece you hear quite a lot from one researcher in particular who is actually very helpful in us understanding what was going on there. You heard at the very beginning with Helen Nez, she doesn't speak English, she speaks Navajo, so we have to use translation. That's difficult to listen to at length. I wanted there to be some of it in there so that you get a chance to hear her voice. You do hear her sister, but you could also tell that her sister is, it's actually kind of hard to hear the sister. So we needed to find somebody to sort of carry the narration of like what's going on there. I did want to start though with Helen because she has this incredibly tragic story that 7 of her 10 children have died of uranium related problems. And then the sister comes in to say, and these neighbors died, and those neighbors are on dialysis. So you're getting a sense of what that community is like. But I also think there's always a tension in stories like this where you have real participants, victims, I don't want to use the word victims, but victims in this story, and they're telling their story. But it's also bigger than her 7 dead children. And that's a hard moment in the piece when you've got to start to back up. And so you can tell how we did that was we're hearing this story of this family with the 7 children who died. And then we back up a little bit. So think of that as a close-up. And then you back up a little bit, and you're in a mid-range shot, and the neighbor here and the neighbor there. And then we go to the toxicologist who can say, I've actually done a big study on this. And here, you know, these 5 times the uranium levels. Yes?
And I'm also thinking about how even a further layer out, as you are bringing this story to us, and we are hearing, and we've been learning so much about the water treatment here and thinking about water there. So I think the story of the water is this larger story. So the story, I think, has in this place another layer of storytelling that I can't not think about. Right. I'm hearing this story, although it's geographically different. It's a similar story about water, but a very different story.
Right, right. Last time I was here, I played a story that I actually had reported out of Holden about the remediation. Decided to not play that this time, but just because I was worried that people would come to last year and this year and get bored with walk out. I think that many people can relate to a story about, like, who doesn't want clean water? Who, you know, everybody wants to have clean water. This story is only 4.5 minutes long, so one of the things that we're always dealing with in NPR is trying to figure out how long to make the story so that you pay attention. It can't be too long. You know, again, remember yesterday I said you're doing many different things in many different places. So it needs to be long enough to get all the material into it, but short enough so that you don't, like, skip out halfway through the story. One of the things that ended up on the cutting room floor in this story is an explanation of why the Navajo are tied to the land. So when you're born on the Navajo Nation, the umbilical cord is buried in the land, and then you're supposed to stay in the land in which your umbilical cord is buried. I love that story. I've actually used that explanation in other stories in the same in this series. It was in another group of stories about why people leave or don't leave the nation. Oh, it was in an education story about why people leave or don't leave the nation. So I thought that, you know, there are ways to sort of keep backing up, and then you find yourself, you find your story in the story. We're going to talk about that today and a bit tomorrow. Let's do 2 more questions.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that to me was the missing piece of this story, was the importance of place. And it's the part that I related to. You asked the question, why don't they leave, right? But you didn't really answer it.
Yeah, we said that they're tied to the land.
Right, and then that left me unsatisfied or right. Dissatisfied, because that's the question I wanted, that's the story I wanted to hear from those folks. Because that's the part of this that, to the extent that people can connect who don't live there.
Right. Well, he says, you know, why don't we have that, what's called the butt cut, when you hear one person talking, then you hear another person talking back, or two characters in the story, where he says, like, a lot of people just say, why don't they leave? And then they don't.
She just doesn't.
Okay. Cool. The problem is, if I turn off, we're recording these sessions, so if I turn it off, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
I think I turn it off and turn it back on.
Like a computer.
Good try.
I apologize. I will try to speak up, but if I try to talk too loudly, I want it voiced by tomorrow. I believe you have something.
Yeah. One of the parts that really got me, like a tip of the iceberg, 500 abandoned mines, only 9 have been worked on to decontaminate. That's 2%.
Right.
I think this is a story about the Navajo people, another tragedy of the government versus the Indian people.
But there's an important detail in that piece that I think we should consider. Court rulings and settlements have actually funded a cleanup of 40% of those mines. That money has gone to the tribes, and the tribes have not, they have the money to clean it up.
Tribes have chosen not to?
So, part of the complicity in this problem is the governance of the tribes.
Because they would be interested.
So I think that that is something that we want, like, the government to be the bad guy and the tribe to be the good guy.
Yes.
And I actually think there are multiple, the reason that I asked you the subjects of the story were is that there are so many characters in this piece, and they're all caught between competing goods. Mm-hmm. You've got the Nez family, and they're sort of at the base level of the victims of this. And then you've got the community, and then you've got the tribe, which is both a victim, but then as the piece reveals, there have been these settlements that there is money, that they haven't used all that money to clean up. They cleaned up 2%. They have the money to clean up 40%. So that's a big difference.
Yeah.
Just to piggyback on that a little bit, they not only have their land, it might not have been their land to start with, it certainly wasn't all of their land, but at some point they were given this land. Then the mines were dug. Who dug the mines? Who gave permission, or was permission given?
Right. In some cases, the tribes gave permission. Like, they didn't really understand. Remember that the Manhattan Project was super secret, and they weren't just walking around going, hey, we're mining uranium for a bomb. A lot of people who were involved in it had no idea. I mean, just did the Manhattan Project. Not even the people making the bomb all knew exactly what. Very few people actually knew what the whole project was.
Yeah.
So they went in and they said, we need to do some mining. What they told the tribes then, what we have records of what they told the tribes then, is all very murky. So at the same time, I've done other stories. There's an interpretive center at Los Alamos that we did a story on a few years ago. And I found it really interesting that there are a number of people from the Navajo Nation who are very proud of the fact that they contributed to this thing that ended World War II. Remember, they both helped build uranium from their land, helped build the bomb. Also, the Navajo Code Talkers were the people who helped pass secret messages. So, it is a fraught relationship, and one of which people are both proud and ashamed. It's one of the reasons that I love doing stories out of Maryland. Yes?
Yeah, I also hear it with hearing Flint. And why, which has its own tragic story and so on, but why do we know the story of Flint so well, and we don't know the story of that? And there's this level of discrimination and interest in things that you hear in our national story,
right,
about what we pay attention to.
Right. I can give a little bit of an explanation for Flint in that it's in a place that's easy to get to.
Yeah.
Laurel is based in Flagstaff, Arizona, and she's got to drive about 5 hours to get to the nation, and then 5 or 6 hours within the nation to get to these places. Now, she does a ton of our reporting on Native issues because she is the closest reporter, who is sometimes 10 to 12 hours from where she needs to be to do stories for us. So that is still a problem, sorry. So sometimes it's just location. Also, I think that issues of racism and African Americans are tied up in Flint, and issues of racism and Native Americans are tied up in the Navajo Nation, and quite often we're more interested in one kind of discrimination than another kind of discrimination. This explains something about the countercultural nature of NPR.
you know, we did included in this larger project on discrimination, we did African-American discrimination. We only did a handful of stories, like two or three there, because we felt like we actually had a whole unit that covers that all the time. And I'm like the one person who's paying attention to major issues, and I don't actually have a full time corresponding, and I work with reporters at member stations in places like the Wind River Reservation, where we, oh, what a great segue, places like the Wind River Reservation, where we're about to go to hear another story from the same series. Just preface, this is a story about sexual assault, so actually, it's a question of whether it was sexual assault. Think about what you think was going on in this story, because I think that we don't, we talked to everybody who was willing to talk to us, and I'm not sure what the truth is of the narrative of this assault yet. So take a listen.
Let's hear what Native Americans think of the justice system. People in minority groups often perceive the justice system differently than others, and many statistics indicate minorities are targeted more often. A poll from NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health offers a striking number. In a survey of Native Americans living in majority Native areas, half said they or a family member have been treated unfairly by the courts. You feel that sentiment when you visit the Wind River Reservation, as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards did.
One morning earlier this year, Northern Arapaho member Rose was sitting at the table with her 14-year-old daughter, Latoya.
I told her to move her hair. She had her hair like this.
Latoya hit her neck and cheek by pulling her hair in front.
I noticed something and she went like that, and she had marks, hickeys, completely covering her, almost even on her face.
That's when Latoya told her mother that she had been forcibly kissed by a woman from another reservation who was 6 years older. Because they're afraid of retaliation, they asked that we use only their middle names.
At that moment, I saw me in her, and there was just nothing I could do for her except let her know that it's not her fault. It's okay, I'll protect you.
Protect her, because when Rose herself was 6, she too was molested by an older girl. Studies show that 1 in 3 Native American women are sexually assaulted in their life, but Rose wanted to stop that cycle. According to the NPR poll, 36% of Native Americans living in majority Native areas say they avoid calling the police because of a fear of discrimination. So Rose called tribal police, but they referred her to the FBI since her tribe isn't qualified to handle felonies. But after an investigation, federal prosecutor Carrie Jacobson declined to pursue Latoya's case. Like most assaults, the case rested solely on the victim's testimony.
The only allegations involved the subject touching the minor's lips, neck, and upper chest, and the knee, and those areas do not fall within the definition of sexual contact.
Jacobson says she recognizes that testifying against a perpetrator can be traumatic, and that's why she leaves cases like this one open as long as possible, in case a victim wants to tell more later. But she says it's much harder to get convictions later.
When a victim gets to a place where he or she feels safe enough and emotionally stable enough to divulge what happened, we have no scientific evidence left. Those are very challenging.
Jacobson did not interview the alleged perpetrator or any witnesses. In fact, a recent Department of Justice report shows that federal courts declined to prosecute 67% of reservation sexual assault cases. And since Latoya's case was dropped, the tribal police have taken over. But unlike the feds, they moved forward, issuing a warrant for the subject's arrest. The problem is, the tribal court can only issue misdemeanors, less than a year in jail. Leslie Shakespeare is a councilman for the Eastern Shoshone, the other tribe on Wind River. He wants to use the recently passed federal legislation called the Tribal Law and Order Act to do more. That law grants tribes the power to give stiffer sentences and do it faster.
The wait is what really disenfranchises people. So when they see that process happening quicker, which doesn't always happen on the federal side, they feel like justice is actually working.
Shakespeare says the new law is motivating the two Wind River tribes to work together to create a stronger, unified court. Rose hopes that means her daughter Latoya's alleged assailant will finally face real justice.
That's the whole thing. She's somewhere, and she's probably somewhere doing this to another 14-year-old.
The new court is scheduled to be up and running by next year. For NPR News, I'm Melody Edwards on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming.
So, I'll start by asking the same questions I asked at the beginning of the last one. Whose story is this? Is this Rose and her mother's story? Is the story of a really complicated justice system where, when it comes to Native American tribal courts versus federal courts? I should say, we reported in the digital version of this piece, we went on at length explaining why it is that the tribe can't prosecute more than misdemeanors. They don't have lawyers, they don't have judges, they don't have enough police to do the kinds of investigations. So it's a combination of the reason that the feds come in to prosecute felonies is that often the tribes don't have the infrastructure to do that. The act that we talked about in this piece and something else, the Violence Against Women Act, have sections in them specific to funding tribes to pay for better training. For instance, there are not very many advocates or judges on the Wind River Reservation actually even have law degrees. So like you couldn't convict somebody of a felony using a judge who isn't actually a lawyer. So there's a really complicated relationship to the law between what the tribes can do and what the feds are brought in to do or agree to do. So who are the characters in the story? Or who do you think the main character of this story was, and whose story is it?
Well, to me, it seems like it's a story of the community.
Okay.
I mean, it's just like you said before. It starts with an example of one person's experience, but the story, 67% never get to court. I mean, the story is the story of a community that has these things happening and not have an avenue for justice for the victims.
So. I have a question about how you feel about the story of Rose's assault.
Before it started, you asked us to think about whether or not we considered it an assault.
Well, because the feds don't.
So can you sort that out a little bit?
The reason I ask it, a couple of reasons. The federal authorities don't. I think that there are issues of perhaps sexual orientation at play here that no one is talking about in this story, and when we asked them, people got really weird about it. And I also, this is going to sound terrible, I had other pieces about intersectionality in this series, and this wasn't one of them, so I didn't want to try to make it do all of that. Could we imagine a situation in which a 16-year-old and a 20-year-old are kissing and they get hickeys? So I don't want to say that is definitely what happened. I think that that possibility arises in this story, and I think that it's something that we should all think about, especially in a story like this. It's two women, they're not that far apart in age. I mean, 6 years, I guess when you're 14 to 20 is farther apart than if you're 20 and 26, but not an unreasonable question, at least.
And we are not hearing from the daughter, if I'm remembering right. We only hear from the mother.
Right, so the mother did not want us to talk to the daughter, but she was willing to tell the daughter's story. The daughter was present for all of the interviews. So this is also part of the complication of the story, right? Mm-hmm. If the daughter were an adult, I would have insisted on interviewing her separately. But when you're interviewing minors, I try to be you have to be respectful of whatever the parents want. And in order to tell the story at all, we had to agree to certain things like middle names, no last names, and no use of the daughter's voice.
It sounds as if maybe the daughter didn't want the mother to know certain things.
So that's actually part of the reason that I'm thinking, like, it wasn't like this happened and then she told her mother about it, but lots of people are embarrassed about sexual assault, even if they're totally the victim. So it's just a question that comes up for me. Like, lots of teenagers have hickeys, like, and they're not of sexual assault. So,
So one of the things that struck me is that this, I mean, so my wife worked for many years at a rape crisis center, and the types of cases that would come come through her office. We're incredibly varied, and very few of them fit our preconceived assumptions about what sexual assault is. And this kind of fits that mold, right? There's a lot of, it doesn't fit the perfect, you know, the perfect template.
Right.
The perfect template is what the prosecutors want, because right. The perfect template is what they can push through.
Right, well, the prosecutor doesn't want to bring a case that fails. She doesn't want to get the hopes of the family up. She doesn't want, you know, a loss on her record.
Yeah. So to what extent, so I guess my specific question that wasn't contextualized in the story, is that 67% of tribal cases that don't move forward, how does that compare more broadly? Is that something that statistic something that points towards, you know, systemic racism, or is that simply reflective of broader broader issues in sexual assault and
trauma? I think that's a good question. I think that it would. There's probably some sort of number. It's also very tricky because federal prosecutors don't bring most sex crime charges.
Right.
Usually it's the DA who does, but there's no DA here. So
it's
a little bit complicated. Like, that federal prosecutor is handling so many things. To compare what they have to do to what, say, a federal prosecutor who brings sex crime charges in Manhattan, like, those are probably really rare and have to reach a very high bar to become a federal crime. Like, it probably has to involve, like, human trafficking.
So in some many respects, the systemic aspect of this is that there's a totally different legal system for this to go through versus, you know, a very similar assault in, you know, any major city in the U.S. that's
right.
going to have a rape crisis center that's funded by VAWA, DAs to mitigate those issues,
right.
and social support.
Right. I mean, also, remember, we have a description, we have the federal prosecutor explaining why this wasn't a sexual assault. It's like, he's up here and here and here and here, but here. But, like, there's an actual, like, range of what constitutes sexual assault, which is, I think, very interesting to me. Like, I didn't know that until this piece.
I mean, just because there's things you can see doesn't mean there aren't other things that happen that you can't see, so that just because you can see. You know, there's
well,
so
I mean,
many.
She did have an exam.
Oh, she did.
Yeah,
she had the whole thing. Okay.
Why was this framed as sexual abuse and not child abuse? This is a 14-year-old
mm-hmm.
who was injured by an adult. Why is that not child abuse? And why would the federal prosecutor not approach it from that standpoint?
I wonder if he could have just approached it as assault.
Yeah.
I mean, assault and not child abuse. And not just childish, but, you know, assault against another person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Is there, yeah?
I'm curious, I remember hearing this story when it came out, and I'm curious about why you chose this particular story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what issue were you trying to illustrate?
I was trying to illustrate how incredibly complicated this is. But I don't really like clear-cut stories where, like, there's a good guy and a bad guy. I like stories that show how incredibly complex the problem is. There's no one way to fix this. Like, you can't just tell the federal prosecutor to prosecute more sex crimes. You can't just, I mean, you'd have to, look, you could, but you'd also have to give them the resources to do it. The frame for this whole piece is Native Americans do not have conflict. Half of Native Americans say, I don't believe the justice system, actually, the court system. Two separate questions. So I would say half Native Americans say the justice system fails them. Harvard asked the question, do the courts work for you? 50% said no. Do police work for you? 50% said no. So we have to sort of, I call that the justice system. So that's the reason I chose the story. I think that it's ambiguous, and I don't want a good guy, a total good guy, and a total bad guy in this story. So, I mean, I worry that the federal prosecutor comes off as terrible, but she's actually, I mean, she's doing everything she can, I think, or she believes she's doing everything she can in order to. She's not just sort of sitting back. You know, she, as we say in the piece, kept it open for more than a year to see if she could gather enough evidence. And at the end, it was going to be, like he said, she said. However, we also point out in the piece, she didn't actually interview the alleged perpetrator. That would be, I think, I mean, if I were an investigator, I would go look, I would ask, I would question the alleged perpetrator. But I also, it made me wonder, did she think this had, this wasn't an assault? Did she think perhaps this was something else?
Well, there's an issue of...
Okay, let's go here and then that. Okay, sorry.
Yes, as serious and sad as this is, and puzzling, what we're hearing now about the disappearance of Native American women who are victims of assault is on a whole different level.
Stay tuned. I have a piece coming out of Montana in a couple of weeks.
That was my question. Okay. Yes. Okay, moving on.
So, you know, I bring in more pieces about Native Americans than any other editor. I actually bring in, I would say, 95% of them at NPR, and that still equals about 12 to 15 per year out of thousands of stories. But it's about 11 more than most other news organizations at this point. So I can only get to one thing at a time in stories. But there is a case in Montana of a Native woman's disappearance that we're working on a story about that will come out in the next couple of weeks.
Good.
I was just going to say that speaking of the prosecutor here, if we're not intervening there, there's an issue of retaliation. The prosecutor know that could take this forward any place, then sort of minimizing maybe the aggravations of retaliation. I mean, it's just so complicated.
Right, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I think that with all sorts of sexual assault and sexual harassment, retaliation is a huge fear, and lots of people don't come forward because of it, and we don't train people. We don't train bystanders or witnesses how to come forward either. We sort of put all the onus on the victim to come forward, but, you know, I don't know that the mother would be considered technically a witness, but she certainly knows her daughter, and she certainly saw the results. One more, and then the next piece I'm going to play is about 10 minutes, so I want to make sure we have time for that.
The question I have is, you know, as a white male, I feel very keenly aware that we've never be so bold to speak for other ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. And how does public radio, I mean, how do you have representation, keen insights from, I mean, here you have possibly a Native American lesbian woman. I mean, how do you tell these stories for these other groups?
We ask ourselves that question all the time. I mean, one of the ways that we address it is to hire diverse reporters. I mean, in this series, one of the reporters was Native American. In this piece we're going to hear tomorrow, I also edited the LGBT section of this. I managed to pull up 5 pieces with no straight white cisgender men in it, reporters or subjects of stories. That was a lot of work, a tremendous amount of work. But to find the healthcare expert on trans issues who is trans himself,
yeah,
that's a lot of work. So, it's something we're constantly aware of, constantly asking ourselves, and we, you know, it's not just the reporter doing the story. The reporter is talking to me. We're also, we had, this was in conjunction with our science desk, so we're talking to people on the science desk, and I actually checked certain language throughout with both the Style Book Committee people of the Native American Journalists Association and with the reporter who did the Howie Echohawk story from beginning of the session, is on the board of the Native American Journalists Association. So I asked him I just didn't want to screw this up because it matters a lot. And so it's something we're aware of, and I try to not go into this with a cavalier attitude. But you know, something we're going to talk about in tomorrow's session is the extent to which people tell stories from their own communities and how you do that both journalistically and because you have a background in that community. How do you ethically tell a story of yourself when you're doing reportage rather than autobiography or memoir? So we're going to get into that a bit tomorrow. So I want to, okay, one more thing, and then we're going to have to play this piece, otherwise we're not going to have time to talk about it.
I just wanted to let your first quote, though, that first clip that you shared with us also, I think, speaks to this, too, that in some respects, expecting the burden of telling that story coming from those who are oppressed is not fair also. And so I do think there's a major responsibility on those of us that have the privilege to be able to speak about these things, to do so and not simply to expect the oppressed to always be the ones telling those stories.
You know, there's this quote that I don't like about journalism, which is like giving voice to the voiceless. Well, they have a voice. I just need to put a mic in front of it. But what I need to do is help them tell their story.
Yeah.
And do it in a sensitive way to not just say, well, it's all your responsibility. A lot of it's my responsibility. A lot of it's the reporter's responsibility. So it's a constant collaboration and conversation to tell it. At the same time, as the journalist, whether the reporter, the editor, or the producer, you have to have a certain amount of distance from the person. Like, it's not just Rose's story. It's actually, we're trying to discover the truth here somewhere. We're trying to help you understand how hard the truth is to find in the story with many, many voices. Okay, I want to play this piece which aired last fall. You all hear the phrase driveway moment. This, I almost never experience these anymore because I am involved in the making of the sausage. But this happened to me with this piece. I apparently was busy with something else that day because I didn't pay too close attention. That wasn't my story, so it's not like I was shirking my responsibility. Somebody else edited it. But let's listen to this. It's about 10 minutes long, and then we'll talk for, I mean, if we run over a few minutes, it's probably not that bad because there's dinner, right? Okay, here we go.
Good evening. Tonight, the subject of abortion. The illegal termination of pregnancy has reached epidemic proportions in this country. The conflict...
I apologize. I have some questions I want you to think about while listening to this piece, and I wrote them down. Because it's a long piece, I thought I'd write them down so you could take a look at it. While we're okay, I'm going to start it over. I only wasted 9 seconds there.
Good evening. Tonight, the subject of abortion. The illegal termination of pregnancy has reached epidemic proportions in this country. The conflict between the law and reality has resulted in a national dilemma. Abortion will...
Monday marks the 45th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, January 22nd, 1973. Before the Supreme Court's decision, abortion was against the law in most of the country. Women who sought out the procedure took risks.
In the 1960s, an underground network of women in Chicago took a different risk. To try to give women seeking abortions a safer alternative. The group was known as Jane. And at first, they connected women with doctors who were willing to break the law and perform the procedure. And eventually, women in the collective trained to perform abortions themselves.
We're going to hear firsthand accounts of what they did and why. These accounts include some graphic descriptions that listeners may find disturbing. Radio Diaries brings us the story of the group.
My name is Wynette Willis. When I was 23 years old, I was a single mom and I became pregnant. It terrified me, the thought of having another kid by myself. I think I was kind of desperate, actually. I remember being on an L on a train platform and seeing a sign. And the sign said, pregnant? And it was a question mark. Don't want to be? Question mark. Call Jane and a phone number. So I called.
My name's Heather Booth. I started Jane in 1965 when a friend of mine was looking for a doctor to perform an abortion. I made the arrangements, then someone else called. Well, by the third call, I realized I couldn't manage it on my own. I thought I'd better set up a system.
My name is Martha Scott. I joined the group in 1969. I had 4 children under the age of 5. Many of us were stay-at-home moms, a bunch of housewives.
I'm Jean Gallitzer-Levy. I was a member of Jane. I was 20 years old. I hadn't had so much as a speeding ticket. But abortion really was the front line. It was where women are dying. There was all kinds of stories out there. You know, people who had used a hanger to stick in themselves to kind of stimulate abortions, but I wasn't gonna do that. So that's why I went to Jane.
Women would call an answering machine. They were asked to give their phone number, their name, and the date of their last period.
We met someone before they were going to do this, We gave them a chance to talk about it, and we told them what was going to happen. There were lots of points along the way where they could have said no, changed my mind. Because you do think about it a lot. I don't think anyone chooses to have an abortion lightly.
I remember the day of, I took public transportation to this apartment in Hyde Park. There was like 7 or 8 people in there, and we waited. At the appointed time, we were put into a car, and we were taken to a second location where the abortion was performed. It felt very underground, you know. I remember looking at the people who performed the surgery, and I felt relief that somebody was going to help me.
Good evening. The facts are astonishing. Hundreds of thousands of pregnant women, unmindful of what may happen to them, secretly seek abortions. For them, there is a wide gulf between what the law commands and what they feel they must do.
My name is Ted O'Connor. I was a young homicide detective on the south side of Chicago. This is a Catholic city. Abortion wasn't even discussed. And I knew nothing about Jane. The whole operation was totally under our radar.
Jane was very organized and very clandestine and secretive. My name is Leslie Regan. I'm a professor of history and author of the book When Abortion Was a Crime. The thing that ultimately made Jane so unique was they took the practice of abortion into their own hands. They decided to learn and perform abortions themselves. And that was a stunning decision.
We told them up front we were not doctors. You know, doctors charged $500 a pop. So we would say, we charge $100, but we will take what you can pay. We were doing 4 days a week, and we were typically doing 10 women a day.
We would rent apartments all over the city. We set up in 2 bedrooms and put linens on the bed and sterilized our instruments so the person who was having the abortion would, you know, stretch out, and the person who was assisting would sit with them while it was happening. And then I would insert the speculum, administer the anesthesia that was delivered via 4 shots to the cervix, and then the cervix would be dilated, and then the instrument would be inserted into the uterus to remove the material. So that was the procedure.
We gave every woman a little pill box with ergotrate to help prevent bleeding, and tetracycline, which is an antibiotic. By and large, we were dealing with healthy women pregnancies. I mean, we were not qualified to deal with somebody with real medical problems.
I probably did hundreds of abortions. I mean, the fact is abortion is a pretty easy procedure. But still, you're messing around inside somebody else's body. It's not necessarily given that you won't do harm. There were problems. There were people who ended up in the emergency room. You know, it wasn't always perfect by any means. You know, we felt it was the right thing to do. But that doesn't mean anything when the police are actually at your door.
It was spring of 1972, and two female Hispanics walked into the police station, and they told us that their sister-in-law was going to have an abortion. Of course, these women were Catholic, and to them, one, was a sin, and two, they didn't want a child killed. That's how they felt. And so, with two unmarked squad cars, we managed to follow our target, drove into the South Shore neighborhood, pulled up in front of one of the apartment buildings, rode up on the elevator, and we saw a young woman, late 20s, extremely well-dressed, and she stopped momentarily and braced herself. She was pale. Looks like the blood had drained out of her face. And my partner took her by the arm, and a very stern voice said, "Did you just have an abortion?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Where?" And she led us to the door. I really didn't know what to expect when I walked in there. Now, the living room was filled with young women. waiting for an abortion. And we said, I was shocked to see it. And of course, they were very surprised when we came in.
They were such Chicago cops, you know? They were burly. They spoke with Southside accents. They came in and looked around and said, where's the doctor? Looking for the guy. But there wasn't any guy, you know, it was just us.
I remember one of the women asked me what I thought these women were supposed to do if they couldn't get an abortion. You know, what did I think was the right thing? And I told her, listen, I don't have any opinions about what they should do, but you're breaking the law. That's all I know. That's why I'm here. So we arrested everybody.
I remember being handcuffed to somebody, and we were all taken down to women's lockup.
We were charged with 11 counts of abortion and conspiracy to commit abortion.
I remember thinking at the time, I can see both sides of this. It's a tough issue. You know, on my side is, I don't want to see a life destroyed. That life is helpless. It has no choice in this. And that angers me. On the other hand, I've never been pregnant.
This is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases...
6 months after the arrest, the Supreme Court decided Roe versus Wade. And ultimately, the charges that had been brought against Jane are dropped.
Anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional.
Roe v. Wade brought an end to Jane, because now there were legal providers. But the controversy didn't just disappear.
Perhaps more than any other issue in American life today, the abortion question is loaded with the emotional arguments of life, death, and morality. Not the kinds of issues a court can finally settle.
Roe v. Wade made such an enormous difference. It was a very important victory. At that point, we all kind of scattered, went on to other things. I mean, we really thought the fact that it was legal would change things, that this wouldn't be as political anymore, that it would fade a lot as any kind of a social issue. But we were wrong. We were wrong.
Jane performed approximately 11,000 first and second trimester abortions before Roe versus Wade. No deaths of women were ever reported in connection with the service.
This story was produced by Nellie Gillis with Joe Richman and Sarah Kate Kramer. It was edited by Deborah George and Ben Shapiro. A special thank you to Laura Kaplan, author of The Story of Jane. You can hear this story and more on the Radio Diaries podcast.
I always like to play the producers' names because they are the people who are the editors' names, because they are the people who are responsible for this for the story.
So let's think about whose story this is. Whose story this isn't? Who's missing? Who's not in this piece?
The fathers.
Okay.
We don't hear from any women who had abortions.
That's my first inclination.
The first woman.
She had an abortion. She didn't have it through Jane, I believe.
No, she went off. She was sitting on a train track on the L. Oh, she called the number.
Right, sorry. I don't know that. But then she becomes involved with Jane. That's
no, she goes to the room and it's
taken. Okay. Yep. Sorry about that.
And her story's there.
Okay, so there is. It starts with a person getting an abortion.
Yeah.
But it's mostly, it is still mostly about the woman who has got an abortion, right?
Yeah.
I think that's interesting to me, that this is the story of Jane, not the story of people having abortions, the story of people performing abortions, and the story of the cop Actually, I would have left the woman who wrote the book out of this piece if I were editing this. I think interviewing her could inform the story, but I felt like it was an unnecessary character in the story. Other ideas about whose story?
I think the police officer was a really important part of it because he was so clear in how he said, I don't have an opinion here, I'm just enforcing the law, which thank goodness for that at that moment that he could be that clear-headed. But then as he looks back, I just love that final line, I've never been pregnant.
Right. You know? He says, I've never been pregnant.
And so he did have an opinion, right?
He did have an opinion.
But he also knows that his opinion isn't the end-all, be-all opinion.
No, I like that.
So that gives you some sense of good.
What strikes me with this story is, and you alluded to this the other day, the power of the story or the control comes from the radio editor. And a different editor could have made this about the criminals, about the foolhardy women risking other women's lives. And we don't know what was left out of the interviews. I assume about 95% of what is said.
Probably.
And just the complete narrative is shaped by the people that were trying to do that video.
So one of the things that I think a lot about when I'm producing stories, I mostly do stories with narrators in them, and stories like this, is who gets to speak first and who gets to speak last. Who do you make the main character of the story? I edited most of our same-sex marriage coverage in the years leading up to the Windsor and Obergefell decisions, and I did an analysis at some point of who was the main character in most of those stories. And I started changing who the main characters were because we always started in the Sun Devil living room of the gay couple. It was a point at which the only thing gay people did in America was get married. Yeah. So then I started with people who didn't want marriage to be legal. So I think, you know, they choose to start with someone who does have an abortion, but the main weight of the story is on the women who perform the abortions, and then the cop is in there. I have a sense, I should actually ask Deb George, who's the editor of this piece, at what point did she tell them to interview, find a cop who was there? I think that the cop is mentioned in the book about the history of Jane. So, in some ways, I think he was probably always there, but he might not have been. And sometimes you start producing a story, and you're producing a story about women who perform abortions, and then you realize this is a really fraught issue, and we do need to have somebody in there representing a voice that is not happy about this thing, and that don't portray these women as the heroes of this story. So I think I would love to at some point, well, I would either love to or be terrified to go back to the people who were in stories a while later, like, you know, a year or two later, and find out, like, how did they feel about the reporting and the way they were portrayed in the story. We have pretty strict ethical rules about how we would read quotes back to people to make sure that we're, like, getting them right and putting them in context, but we would never play a whole piece for somebody before a piece airs, because we have to be in control of the story, not them.
Yes. But how often do you get feedback when people are angry about the way it came out, even though you played in quotes?
Right.
But do they ever come after you and say, wow, that's not what we wanted?
Not very often. People who get mad, who come back to us and say you did a terrible thing to us, are quite often elected officials who like were speaking publicly and didn't expect to be quoted speaking. But you know, they were at a campaign rally, and we got them on a sort of uncomfortable interaction with one of their constituents, like, and they got upset with us. Well, they seem to think that we are part of their PR machine, and we're not. There's a reason we don't like check to make sure they're okay with everything we do. Now, we tell them we're reporting it, and we want to give them a chance to respond to it. And in some cases, we would actually, you know, read a big chunk of a story so that, like, here's what people are saying about you.
Yeah.
What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so I'd want to go back to your theme of today. Mm-hmm. And it's not quite the same thing, but in my life, I've been in stories maybe a half a dozen times, but I have worked with people who've been stories dozens of times. And more often than not, my experience has been the story is not accurate. It doesn't really tell the true story because of, and this is in journalism, not in radio, because of this need that journalists have of presenting counterfacts, right? Here's one perspective, mm-hmm. here's the other perspective, as if those are equally true,
right.
which they're often never equally true.
Right.
And but because they are forced to be objective, you get this notion that there's equivalence in those two positions. But like you say, it's really complicated often.
Right.
And more often than not, by making those equivalences, you actually don't. So I never believe anything I read. I mean, in the paper. In the sense that I never believe that this is the full story. It's a story that a reporter's put together to meet that standard of equivalence. And so when you get to these intimate stories, it then becomes even more, I've never been a subject of that kind of thing.
Right.
I think it becomes even more problematic.
Yeah, I mean, my response to that tends to be that people can't tell their story. That people can tell their stories. They can't tell a larger story because
right.
they are a subject within a story, but there are other people's stories. That's why I know that a lot of, as Jen Hoffman said and I talked about yesterday, you know, people always feel betrayed when they're the subjects
right.
of pieces of journalism, or people often feel betrayed. I think that that's probably true because I think that the truth that the journalist is trying to tell is not the truth that you might have in the experience of, because you weren't in the car with the cop. I mean, you know, in this story, you don't hear the cop. You're like, the person, you know, in that apartment doesn't know the cop's perspective. So the idea is that you will have these multiple voices and that the truth emerges from that. Now, I also do understand your point about false equivalency. I think that, like, to a lesser extent NPR, but a lot of organizations during, in reporting on climate change, did this false equivalency thing, which I think
those are the stories
deeply,
I'm talking about,
yeah,
actually.
Deeply, deeply problematic. You know, NPR, more than a decade ago, just decided that, like, if we cover a controversy within climate change, it's that there is, like, some fight at a school board level about what's in a textbook, but if we're just talking about, like, scientists are working on climate change and here's a thing that they're doing, like, it is a true thing that there is, that we
there is a truth. There is actually a truth.
Yes. I mean, and now we're also in the situation, like, I argue with several of my bosses about this periodically, but I also think that I am just not interested in sticking people who are, like, upset about same-sex marriage in every story that involves same-sex marriage or gay people. It's like, and what do you think about AIDS, too, while you're at it? Like, it's a kind of a dumb response, and when I make the AIDS analogy, they understand why I think it's a dumb response. It's also, I mean, I had this very spirited argument with one of my bosses about the Muslim series that we're going to hear parts of tomorrow in this session, about how, to what extent to refer to Islamophobia in America as all the result of 9/11, and when do you bring up 9/11 in a story about discrimination against Muslims. He believed it was the whole context. And I said, there was a lot of anti-Muslim discrimination prior to, I know because I covered it. Like, you can't open a mosque in America without a huge fight. So, let's, like, maybe one more thing that I want to get you to dinner. Yes?
So, on the topic of that false equivalency and presenting people in a true light and their own light, I'm a journalism major in my undergrad, and they talk, we do a lot of practicing that, and especially at Western, we're really concerned with the environment and making sure that, you know, we had a very specific discussion that was, you don't need to bring up a climate change denier every time you talk about the climate. You need to find the smaller story, and that's exactly what has kind of happened here, I think, is that they found the smaller story and connected it to a larger one, which is where the truth gets obfuscated and changes and becomes not necessarily less truthful, but less personal.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. A little preview of tomorrow. We're gonna, so separate series that I worked on. was a Muslims in America series that aired earlier this year in conjunction with a big, there was a big piece in National Geographic, also by Leila Fadel, that I also edited that you may have read in National Geographic. And we're going to play a couple more pieces from the discrimination series, although these will be on the LGBT part of the discrimination series, and they both focus on transgender issues. So see you tomorrow.